The story of Motown Records is as legendary as the music that rocked and rolled out of its Detroit studios. Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, Smokey Robinson, The Supremes, and so many other greats started as disciples of Motown impresario Berry Gordy. Very superstitious, writings on the wall. Very superstitious, letters about to fall. Many writers have visited the hallowed studios of Motown and the tangled tales of alleged deceit and deception. The latest entry to tell the company's tale comes from Gerald Posner in his new book aptly titled Motown, Music, Money, Sex, and Power. Posner joins us from our New York studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Leanne.
When someone says the Motown sound to you, what do you hear?
I think of just sort of a hodgepodge of songs that come rushing through to me. Classics that sound as good today as they did 30 years ago. And whether they happen to be a Four Tops song or whether it's Bernadette that I'm listening to or something that's as silly as Baby Love, the great thing is they're 2.5 minute to 3 minute pop songs that just have a sound that's very much the 60s, but is very current as well and hasn't really dated. You know it when you hear it.
I need love, love to ease my mind. I need to find someone to call mine. But mama said, you can't hurry love. No, you just have to wait. She said, love don't come easy. Well, I had you to myself. I didn't want you around. Those pretty faces always make me stand out in a crowd.
You know, I asked Berry Gordy what he heard when someone said to him the Motown sound, and he said that he didn't hear music. He defined it as rats, roaches, soul, guts, and love.
That's a wonderful Gordy quote, and it's very interesting because I think Gordy's ear was remarkably good, better than I thought before I started this work. I didn't think Gordy was as key as he turns out to be. Gordy wasn't just the one with the idea to start Motown, but that ear was so good that he really did know what was a hit, and that's why they focused on those singles and turned them out. And I think what Gordy heard in some ways, I mean, this is being facetious, but he heard a cash register ringing. Gordy knew what would sell and really was unerring in putting the things aside that weren't moving out, knowing when to recycle a hit. I mean, you look at something like I Heard It Through the Grapevine. Gladys Knight does it originally. Gordy knows it's going to be good. Knight and the Pips put it out. It sells a million copies. It looks like it's wonderful. Finally, Norman Whitfield keeps coming back and saying, by the way, I want to do it again, but I think we can do it with Marvin Gaye. Gordy has him go through about 5 different renditions until they get a mix that's right. They put it out. It's completely different. It sells 4 million copies. So Gordy did have that ability to know what was going to cross over and sell big numbers. Don't you know that?
Gordy was also a Svengali of sorts. I mean, not only did he concentrate on the music, but he concentrated on appearance. He wanted the whole package. The costumes, you heard about the charm school lessons, the dancing lessons. He had an image that he was trying to sell.
You're absolutely right. And it's so interesting that when you look at the Four Tops, you look at the Temptations and those unbelievable outfits and the way that they would move on stage, and you think, my God, what great talent. It was really coordinated very, very well by Gordy, as you said. Gordy really had created, I think, in the music business, a version of what the studio system had been in Hollywood. This is somebody who thought that he could run it all from the very start. You would sign a star, you would create them, you would manage them. There was no lawyers and managers in between Gordy and the act. He acted as the management as well. You would do their finances. Many of these acts never saw a tax return. Gordy would pay their taxes. Everything was taken care of for them. They needed a check. It would be given to them. They had no idea of how much money they made, which led to problems down the road eventually when there were big stars and wanted to know how much was in their bank accounts. But he was a control person. Now, he was only in his 30s, but these kids were in their... I mean, Stevie Wonder's 10 at the time. The Jacksons, when they signed Michael Jackson's 10. You're talking about Smokey Robinson's old at 18 when he releases his first song. Martha Reeves is all of 18. The Supremes are 15 and 16. So they were really kids, and he becomes their mentor, and as you said, that Svengali figure in some ways.
Why did some of the acts then come around later after they had made it and sort of bite him for what he had done?
That's the fascinating part of the Motown story, the business story to me here. And maybe it's inevitable to this type of extended family, because that's really what it is. It is this, it's almost like you're looking at the House of Morgan in the banking industry, but here you're looking at Motown and these stars that we've become so accustomed to. And they are an extended family that live together. They travel together. They would go on the bus tours down to the South starting in 1962 on the Motown Review. They had affairs together. They married together. You have Marvin Gaye marrying Gordy's sister, producers are marrying the stars. It's an amazing sort of incestuous family. And in the course of that, as some acts became dominant and grew to real power and success, there was jealousies and cross rivalries. Diana Ross starts an affair with Gordy and therefore causes a lot of problems with other female acts in the label who think they're being overlooked because Diana's getting all the favors. And finally, when the groups are at their very peak in the late 60s, in the beginning of 1970, they've grown up a little bit. They aren't 16. They're 22, 23, 24, and they're starting to ask the questions of, okay, what's happened to all the money? I've had 5 number one hits. What's going on? And they're looking at that. And when they get answers they don't like, boy, it causes some real problems.
So it wasn't just a family. It was, in your words, a dysfunctional family.
It became a dysfunctional family. And maybe that was inevitable in some ways. I mean, first of all, there are a lot of egos involved, clearly, with, you know, artists who all want to vie for being the number one hit. And if one is number one at the time and another one's not breaking into the top 10, it's always because they think they didn't get enough attention from the boss. Gordy was the one giving the attention. And I think that Gordy's affair with Diana Ross creates a problem here. Clearly, when you have an affair with the boss, you do get the feeling that you're getting favored treatment. And Diana not only had that treatment, I think, vis-a-vis other acts with Gladys Horton and others of the Marvelettes, but she got it even in the Supremes itself when it came to issues with Mary Wells and others. So that those created an impression that Gordy was no longer the hit maker that was fair and balanced, but he had his own favorites, and that worked against him eventually.
Did you try to talk to Berry Gordy?
Oh, did I? I will tell you that one of the frustrating things for me here is that I would have loved to have sat down with Gordy. There were just things that I wanted to ask him. The investigative side of my reporting wasn't what drove me on this story. I did not approach Motown as an investigative story. I approached it instead as this great, really, as I said to you before, extended family. It was a great social story that you couldn't make up the cast of characters. You can't come up with Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye and the Supremes and the Temps and the Four Tops and Gordy and Suzanne DePass and all of the people that made Motown happen if you were a novelist in many ways. So that telling the story from the inside and the business part of the story is always what I wanted. I think that the investigative part of my work from earlier days worked against me, however. When I go to Berry Gordy, and in essence what I'm saying in my first letter to him is, by the way, I'm the biographer of Joseph Mengele and Lee Harvey Oswald. Will you sit down and talk to me about your company? He has to think this is all scuttlebutt. This is somebody who's looking at the Hollandozier Holland suit. He's going to cut the details of royalties. I'm going to be reading about contracts and what happened on this payment to that. It's a no-win proposition for him. So he never would agree to, even though I kept saying this is the story of Motown and therefore a good story, I couldn't get him to agree to sit down. It's one of my great regrets.
Gerald Posner. His new book is called Motown Music, Money, Sex, and Power, and it's published by Random House. He joined us from New York. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Leanne, so much.
And it hurts so bad. Before you won the heart, you were a perfect guy. But now that you got me, you wanna leave me behind.